This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
That many of our officers don't even understand, don't even know French or Creole in terms of even communicating with the Haitians. It would be a problem.
That's former Kenyan Defense Secretary Eugene Wamalwa expressing concern about a Kenyan mission to help Haiti fight gangs that have overrun parts of the country. Details coming up. Also, the World Food Program warns of a looming disaster in South Sudan, and Egypt's President Sisi plans to run for re-election. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. The United Nations Security Council has approved a resolution to authorize a multinational force to Haiti, led by Kenya, to help combat violent gangs that have overwhelmed police. Haiti requested an intervention force a year ago, but neither the United States nor the UN were willing to lead one. Kenya stepped up in July with an offer to lead a multinational force. Today in Nairobi, Kenyan President William Ruto said his government is ready to take on the mission.
I welcome the resolution as an overdue and critical instrument to define the multinational mission. This mission is a fundamental intervention to provide the necessary conditions for Haiti to consolidate its development and governance. It is therefore absolutely essential that resources, as well as operational scope available to the UN team, as well as other humanitarian and development actors on the ground in Haiti, be appropriately reinforced.
While some Kenyans say their country's leading role in the Haiti mission is a good idea, others are expressing concerns about the proposal. VOA's Nairobi Bureau Chief Mariama Diallo has the story.
Kenyans are divided on the issue of sending 1,000 members of its police force to help quell gang violence in Haiti.
There are countries much stronger than us who could have intervened first. Those criminal elements in Haiti, first of all, I think they don't need police. They need soldiers.
I think that the Kenyan police force is a force that we have. We have faith in it, and there's no reason why we should doubt their capacity.
The Kenyan government says Haiti's far-off location in the Caribbean isn't a deterrent.
We decided we are going to go and help Haiti.
Cabinet Secretary for Foreign and Diaspora Affairs Alfred Mutua recently announced Kenya is ready to lead the multinational police force.
We've got other African nations that are coming on board. We've got other nations from all the world. They're saying if Kenya is leading it, we think there's going to be success. So they're coming on board.
On a recent visit to Kenya, U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin lauded the plan.
And we intend to work with the United States Congress to provide up to $100 million in support. And we urge others in the international community to follow Kenya's great example.
Austin was in Nairobi with his Kenyan counterpart, Adan Dwale.
Kenya has a very long history of global peacekeeping. We were in Kosovo, we were in Namibia, we were everywhere. We are now in Somalia, we are in DRC. We have our officers in the Tigray monitoring and evaluation mechanism.
But others, like former Kenyan Defense Secretary Eugene Wamalwa, disagree.
First of all, what interest would we have to be in Haiti as a third world country that is over 12,000 kilometers away, that many of our officers don't even understand, don't even know French or Creole in terms of even communicating with the Haitians? It would be a problem. And even in terms of training and preparation to engage in such a complex security situation, where there's urban warfare with the gangs.
Vincent Kimosop is a Kenyan economist and policy analyst.
It's unprecedented. We only get to hear about Haiti if it is not natural disasters, the issues of insecurity, political instability. But you know, the people who are in Haiti have an African descent. And we have an Ubuntu philosophy in Africa. I am because you are, and because you are, I am. Yeah. So when you remove the political, eventually a decision to go help a neighbor who is struggling will be loaded within a broader conversation in the African context.
Kimosop says he supports the administration's decision, but also believes the government should be more transparent and communicate more with the Kenyan public. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Nairobi.
The World Food Programme warns a hunger emergency is looming in South Sudan as aid agencies run out of resources needed to care for tens of thousands of people who have crossed the border from conflict-ridden Sudan. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Nearly 300,000 people have fled to South Sudan since conflict erupted in Sudan in April. The World Food Programme reports more than 1,000 people continue to arrive every day. It says most of the new arrivals are returnees, South Sudanese who had been living in Sudan as refugees for many years. Speaking from Juba today, WFP country director in South Sudan, Mary Ellen McRorty, says people crossing the border tell harrowing tales of escape as they made their way to South Sudan.
We're talking of robbery, sexual violence, and long journeys on foot with no food or water. By the time they arrive in South Sudan, the resources have been depleted and they're already well on their way to a hunger emergency. The families that we see crossing today are much, much more vulnerable and food insecure than those that arrived in the early weeks of the conflict, and it's getting worse.
McRorty says 90% of families have gone multiple days without eating. She says recent WFP data also show that 1 in 5 children and more than a quarter of mothers screened at the border are malnourished. She says the situation is further exacerbated by ongoing rain and flooding that has wiped out roads in Renk, the main border crossing from Sudan. She says the mud and stagnant water in makeshift camps for people in transit are the perfect breeding ground for disease. She says WFP is supporting the newly arrived families with hot meals, high-energy biscuits, dry rations, and cash transfers. But she notes WFP barely has the money to feed these families today, let alone to help them build a sustainable future.
Many of the communities people are returning to are also facing humanitarian crises of their own, driven by conflict, climate crisis, and soaring food prices. So far, we have registered over 220,000 returnees arriving some of the most food insecure zones of the country. These returnees are fleeing danger, the danger of war, to a situation of absolute despair.
McRorty says WFP has received less than half of the $526 million it needs to run its humanitarian operation for the next 6 months. Because of the severe funding shortage, she says WFP has been forced to slash food rations by half for people who already are chronically hungry. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The South Sudan government has launched an investigation into the killing of a U.S.-British journalist, Christopher Allen. Reporter Waka Simon Wudu in Juba says South Sudan's Minister for Cabinet Affairs, Martin Elia Lumoro, issued an order yesterday establishing a six-member committee to investigate Allen's death. The U.S.-British journalist was killed in South Sudan in 2017. The committee is expected to submit its findings within 2 weeks. Majak Daniel Kouani, the Secretary General of the Union of Journalists, welcomes the decision to investigate Allen's death, adding that it was long overdue. Allen, a freelance journalist, was killed when fighting erupted between former rebels of the SPLA-IO and government forces in central Equatoria state along the border between South Sudan and Uganda in 2017. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Eswatini, Africa's last absolute monarchy, says last week's legislative elections were a huge success and that 51 men and 8 women were elected as members of the lower house of parliament, which plays only an advisory role to the monarch. King Maswati III, who has ruled for 37 years, will appoint 10 other members. South African opposition parties say they'll be heaping pressure on the ruling African National Congress, the ANC, to try to ensure democratic reform in neighboring Eswatini. Swazis voted for Parliament Mime in the small kingdom on Friday, but in a country where political parties are prohibited from participating, pro-democracy activists labeled the poll illegal. Darren Taylor reports.
Thousands of Swazis voted for leaders of Tinkundlas, or tribal communities, to go to parliament. But many thousands stayed away from the polls in protest against what they call an undemocratic, repressive system of government. In Eswatini, political parties aren't allowed to campaign. Only individual candidates are permitted to stand for election to the House of Assembly. This is true democracy, says government spokesman Alpheus Nkomalo.
There is no law in this country that bans political parties to participate in our elections. That is if they do so as individuals. Members of political parties are not banned from participating in these elections and any other elections. And right now, as we talk, we are waiting for a swearing in of new members of parliament, some of them members of political parties, like Mage Masimelane.
Pro-democracy activists argue that new MPs are always friendly to the king and never representative of a real opposition. The real opposition, they say, is in exile, fearing for their lives. Many of King Mswati's opponents have been assassinated and jailed in recent years, and his security forces have met protests against his rule with deadly force. Nkumalo says the king's police, soldiers and judiciary only act against criminals who incite violence. He insists that unknown terrorists are murdering many people in Eswatini, including tribal chiefs loyal to the king.
We still have got somebody who is going to be standing for trial in the country very soon, who was calling himself a commander, directing his forces from the Republic of South Africa, using the soil of the Republic of South Africa to launch his aggression, his killings and his murders into the soil of the Kingdom of Eswatini.
But South African opposition party MP Julius Malema says it's a false narrative to blame mysterious foreign-based forces for turmoil in Eswatini. He told media in Northwest Province he'll be pushing President Cyril Ramaphosa to pressure Mswati for democratic reform in Eswatini.
It's a joke. It's a mockery of democracy. There are no elections in Eswatini. What the king is doing is really undermining the will of the people. The political parties must be allowed to contest for political power. We want a democratic Swaziland. And we are going to continue to support the struggle of the people of Swaziland for democracy to take place in Swaziland.
The system that doesn't allow political movements to contest elections as parties allows King Mswati to hand-pick individuals, including relatives, for senior positions in government. And this he's set to do again. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
A military court has sentenced a Congolese military colonel to death and convicted 3 soldiers in the deaths of more than 50 people. The Democratic Republic of the Congo has not enforced the death penalty in more than 20 years. Reporter Jafar Al-Katanti Sabiti in Goma tells VOA's Carol Van Damme that before the protests occurred, the Congolese forces fired in Wazalindo demonstrators in the streets.
It was in September 30 in their church where they killed at least 56 people. And the trial was ongoing in Goma. And then yesterday night, the Supreme Military Court of North Kivu decided to sentence Colonel Mike Mekombe to death.
This was all the result of some people that were planning to protest. They hadn't even protested yet against the UN peacekeeping mission in Congo. Is that right?
Yes, that said, the Wazalendo people are upset. A church who was involved in protesting against UN, and they were planning to protest that day on August 30. They planned to demonstrate against UN, and in their plan, as their leader said in a video, the plan was to go to destroy the UN installation and then build a statue of Patrice Emery Lumumba. And then FRDC, under the command of this colonel, Mike Mekombe, attacked them early morning. It was 3 a.m. local time, and started shooting at them. Many people were being killed and others injured. And these people still anger against UN because survivors say if their families and friends were killed by FRDC, it was because FRDC was about to protect MONUSCO and all UN mission in Congo. And I talked last week to some family members of people who were killed. They say they won't stop fighting against MONUSCO. This is still the beginning, but they continue protesting, doing whatever they can so that MONUSCO will leave the country.
The UN mission has been facing increasing pressure to leave Congo. They've been there for quite a while, like more than two decades. Why do so many people want the UN mission to leave?
That's also a question which other Congolese are asking themselves, because everybody here in Eastern Congo needs to see MONUSCO leave in the country. And last year, there were some protests where the common of Congolese were demonstrated to ask UN to leave. And UN accepted to leave, and the plan has been scheduled. But this church wants UN to leave immediately, at the same moment, the same day. And they already gave them a day to leave. It was about 1 month after their last demonstration. So for them, MONUSCO had to leave the DRC on 30 September. And we don't know why, but their leader said God told him to do. So he's pushing UN to leave as a message coming from God himself.
The sect known as the Wazalendo organized the protest. Can you tell us more about that sect?
Yes, the sect is called Wazalendo, but Wazalendo is not their official name. The word Wazalendo means patriot. So that church believes that it's patriot church of Congo, as all churches came from Western and Asia, as Islam came from Arabic people and Christian came from Europe. So they are Congolese believers. That's why they call themselves Wazalendo.
That's reporter Jafar Al-Katanti Sabiti. He was speaking with my colleague Carol Van Damme. Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi confirmed yesterday that he will run for a third term in December's election. In announcing his plan to run, Sisi said, "Just as I responded to the call of the Egyptians before, today I respond to their call again." While Sisi told the Egyptian people if they want to replace him, the ballot box is the way. The campaign of Ahmed al-Tantawi and the most prominent potential opponent to Sisi has complained that citizens have been impeded when they tried to support his candidacy. Said Sadiq, professor of political sociology at the Egypt-Japan University in Alexandria, discussed the election with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi.
politics in the Middle East are usually behind a strong one-man show who stays in power for a long time, whether this is a monarchy or a republic. There was no surprise in this announcement, taking into consideration this long political tradition in the area, including Egypt. So nobody had been shocked. Nobody was surprised. And so this is a continuation of a tradition and a political culture in the area with that idea that the incumbent president stays on for a long time and he can only be removed either through divine intervention, revolution, military coup, assassination, but not through the ballot box. So no surprise here.
Well, President Sisi told the Egyptian people if they wanted to replace him, the ballot box is the way. The campaign of Ahmed al-Tantawi, a former member of the parliament and the most prominent potential opponent to Sisi, has complained that citizens have been impeded when they try to register their support for his candidacy. Egyptian National Election Authority has called such allegations baseless. How do you explain this discrepancy?
Historically, since the establishment of the Egyptian Republic 1953, the political culture and the state remained biased toward backing any incumbent head of state, and they are not positive or responsive to any rival candidate. There is no surprise here unless the state becomes neutral toward all candidates and absorbs the idea that an incumbent head of state or president can lose through free and fair elections. So far, this cultural change has not happened. And that's why you are seeing they say one thing, but on the ground, something else takes place.
Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi warned that his country could face weeks of unrest from 100,000 people in difficult economic circumstances and said, imagine if I give each one £1,000, a pack of narcotics and tramadol, they can cause turmoil with a cost of only $30 million. What was the purpose of this strange warning and how was it received among Egyptians?
As you know, improvising and not reading a written speech is very much characteristic of speeches made by President Sisi. And this always causes a lot of confusion, misunderstanding, and speculations. That's why even some of his spin doctors became apologetics and even slightly criticized such statements. And even some state-run media removed them from their sites. Why? Because these statements are open for wild interpretations. As you know, the presidential election was not scheduled to be held so early, but in the middle of next year. It was advanced because the Egyptian government is obliged to carry out some difficult, certainly unpopular economic decisions in agreement with the IMF that may affect the currency and food prices. So the statement by Sisi may have been a forewarning against any future potential riots and disorders related to food prices, I believe.
That was Said Sadiq, professor of political sociology at the Egypt-Japan University. He was speaking to VOA's Mohamed Al-Shenawi. Pierre Agostini, Frank Crozat, and Anne Lahoulière were awarded the Nobel Physics Prize today for research into tools for exploring electrons inside atoms and molecules. The Nobel jury said they were honored for experimental methods that generate attosecond pulses of light for the study of electron dynamics in matter. The research has potential applications in electronics and medical diagnostics. Agostinis is a professor of Ohio at Ohio State University in the U.S., while Crozat is a director at the Max Planck Institute in Germany. Lahoulière, the fifth woman to be awarded the Physics Prize, is a professor at Lund University in Sweden. Yesterday, the Nobel for Medicine was awarded to messenger RNA researchers Kathleen Carrico and Drew Weissman for their research that paved the way for mRNA COVID-19 vaccines. Tomorrow, the Chemistry Prize will be awarded and the Highly Watched Literature and Peace Prizes to be announced on Thursday, and Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Adrius Regas, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.